Here's a Japanese sandman sneaking on with a mule. Just an old second-hand man.
Hello and welcome to The Good Friends of Jackson Elias, a regular podcast about Call of Cthulhu,
horror films,
and horror gaming in general.
I'm Paul Fricker.
I'm Scott Dolwood.
And I'm Matt Sanderson.
And this episode, we're looking at the ocean in Call of Cthulhu.
But before we get into all that benthic stuff, what is going on?
Well, I hear Paul's making me pretty jealous and he's heading off to sunnier climes in April.
Is Michigan sunny?
Anywhere is more fucking sunny than this country at this time of year.
So, yes, I'm off to Chaosium Con in Ann Arbor, Michigan, which starts on the 18th to 21st of April 2024. That's, well, as it says, the Chaosium Convention, so it has all the various Chaosium games being represented there. Yeah, with lots of games going on, and there's, what else is there? The auction, there's a meet and greet on the Thursday evening, there's a trade hall, all manner of fun things. So if you're going along, please do say hi. And I'll see you there.
I know that there are a number of our listeners who are going to be there just because I've spoken to them about it on Discord. And I think there's going to be quite a large contingent from Ain't Slade Nobody there as well.
All right. Cool. And now on to our main topic, the ocean in Call of Cthulhu.
Lovecraft's work is filled with his personal fears. Among those, the ocean is one of the greatest, appearing regularly as a motif in his fiction. As a result, Call of Cthulhu is filled with marine horrors. In this episode, we'll look at how Lovecraft presented the terrors of the deep, how they've been used in gaming, and what inspiration we can draw upon for our own games.
Well, let's start off by looking at how Lovecraft represented the ocean in his own work.
Yeah, one of the first was Dagon in 1917. This is the first of Lovecraft's stories to deal with lost structures under the sea, and especially ones brought to the surface by tectonic or volcanic activity. Here a man flees in a lifeboat after his cargo vessel is captured by the German Navy. He awakes to find his boat has run aground on a slimy expanse of hellish black mire, extending in monotonous undulations as far as he can see.
This is the risen seabed punctuated by the carcasses of decaying fish. You can almost smell the aroma. And less describable things. After a few days' travel across the strange landscape, he encounters a... dot dot dot.
Cyclopean monolith, on whose surface I could now trace both inscriptions and crude sculptures. The writing was in a system of hieroglyphics, consisting for the most part of conventionalized aquatic symbols, such as fishes, eels, octopi, crustaceans, mollusks, whales, and the like. And several characters obviously represented marine things which were unknown to the modern world, but whose decomposing forms I had observed on the ocean-risen plain. It was the pictorial carving, however, that did most to hold me spellbound. I think that these things were supposed to depict men, at least a certain sort of men, though the creatures were shown disporting like fishes in the waters of some marine grotto, or paying homage at some monolithic shrine, which appeared to be under the waves as well. They were damnably human in general outline, despite webbed hands and feet, shockingly wide and flabby lips, glassy bulging eyes, and other features less pleasant to recall.
Yeah, now, I mean, this is written, what, 13, 14 years before The Shadow of Rinsmouth.
Yeah.
But these are clearly... well, maybe he didn't have the name Deep Ones at the time, but these are clearly Deep Ones, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So it's something deep in Lovecraft's imagination is these kind of fish people.
And also very much this whole idea of things rising from the depths.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
We see this over and over again, I think.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we'll see a few more examples, but it seems like every time Lovecraft incorporates the ocean in his work, or almost every time, it's something rising from the depths.
Well, and this sort of brings to mind reverse Atlantis, really. You know, Atlantis is a lost civilization that's supposed to be lost under the sea. But if the sea can bear it up, then there's Atlantis, this lost civilization, or the remnants of it, the architecture of it, and so on. I wonder if that kind of thing is partly in his mind, you know, those stories of sunken palaces and so on that do exist in the real world.
Very much so, yeah, because I think we'll see that in the next story.
Just to be clear, I'm not saying Atlantis exists in the real world, but there are sunken ruins and so on.
It's okay. This is a safe space for you to talk about theosophy, Paul.
Okay.
If you want to discuss these lost sunken civilizations, we're here for it.
Yeah, we're back with, what's the TV man? The guy who does the shows about lost civilization, Graham Hancock.
Mm.
Oh, right, yes.
Yeah.
Ancient apocalypse and all, and other dubious historical facts, yeah.
He's always going on about places under the sea. He loves all that.
I've never actually seen any of his programmes, so I'll take your word for it.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, yeah.
I have, and I feel the void left in my, what was previously my IQ, before I watched it, yeah.
But they're all linked together, Matt.
It's all connected.
It is all connected. They're great. They're great inspiration for games. Don't take them too seriously, obviously, but yeah.
As an aside, there is actually a great YouTube channel that I can recommend that did a series of, I watched Graham Hancock's Ancient Apocalypse So You Didn't Have To. And by God, that puts a whole lot of that stuff in more real world perspective, which is probably more infinitely useful for real factual basis for gaming than it is actually watching Hancock's stuff himself.
Well, I guess watching the two is quite good.
All this nonsense about sunken civilizations and so on may be absolute bollocks, but it's really useful for Lovecraftian horror because Lovecraft and the people he wrote with incorporated so much of this stuff that you don't have to take it seriously to find it useful to mine for your games.
Hmm, exactly.
Next up is a personal favourite of mine, The Temple from 1920. In the story, a German U-boat crew discover a sunken city which they take to be Atlantis. The vessel is followed by an increasing number of strange dolphins that do not ever seem to need to surface for air. Spooky.
This is something that I'd forgotten until I was going through this, which is fucked up dolphins in Lovecraft. Because here you've got bits of the perhaps in the strange high house in the mist with them accompanying Nodens. And I can't remember, there was another story as well. And you think of dolphins, at least in fiction, as being these sort of friendly, cute creatures and so on. But no, Lovecraft looks at dolphins and thinks, no, spooky. And I do like the idea of these weird dolphins that just congregate around this ship, that just seem to be able to swim deeper and deeper under the ocean without ever surfacing. There's no explanation for it, which is what makes it so weird.
Puts Flipper in a whole new light.
Perhaps these dolphins were actually fish. Because they don't need to surface for air, right?
Mammals.
Exactly. On August the 9th, we espied, and that is a good word, espied. On August the 9th, we espied the ocean floor and sent a powerful beam from the searchlight over it. It was a vast undulating plain, mostly covered with seaweed and strewn with shells of small mollusks. Here and there were slimy objects of puzzling contour, draped with weeds and encrusted with barnacles, which Cleanser declared must be the ancient ships lying in their graves. He was puzzled by one thing, a peak of solid matter protruding above the ocean bed nearly 4 feet at its apex and about 2 feet thick, with flat sides and smooth upper surfaces which met at a very obtuse angle. I called the peak a bit of outcropping rock, but Cleanser thought he saw carvings on it. After a while, he began to shudder and turned away from the scene as if frightened. yet could give no explanation, save that he was overcome with the vastness, darkness, remoteness, antiquity, and mystery of the oceanic abysses.
And that does just seem to feel like the same landscape as we encountered in Dagon, except just still under the sea. The narrator then puts on a deep-sea diving suit and heads out the submarine to explore, encountering strange lights in the ocean depth and a sound oddly like choral music that apparently originates from this sunken temple. The sound and the sight of what he describes as objects both stationary and moving drive the crew to madness and destruction.
Next up, moving forward a couple of years, we've got The Horror at Martin's Beach by Sonia Green and H.P. Lovecraft. On May 17th, the crew of the fishing smack Alma of Gloucester under Captain James P. Orne killed, after a battle of nearly 40 hours, a marine monster whose size and aspect produced the greatest possible stir in scientific circles and caused certain Boston naturalists to take every precaution for its taxidermy preservation. And that immediately brings to mind that scene from Jaws of, hey, the taxidermist is going to have a heart attack when he sees what I brought him. The object was some 50 feet in length, of roughly cylindrical shape, and about 10 feet in diameter. It was unmistakably a gilled fish in its major affiliations, but with certain curious modifications, such as rudimentary forelegs and six-toed feet in place of pectoral fins, which prompted the widest speculation. Its extraordinary mouth, its thick and scaly hide, and its single, deep-set eye were wonders scarcely less remarkable than its colossal dimensions. And when the naturalist pronounced it an infant organism, which could have not been hatched more than a few days, public interest mounted to extraordinary heights. That is one big-ass baby.
It sure is, man. Yeah.
I hadn't read this story for something like 40 years, and I quickly reread it before doing this episode, and I'd forgotten all of this. And I'd also forgotten that this creature does actually appear in a published scenario. At least one, but certainly one that I've played. I won't say which one because it's a spoiler, but let's just say that it appears in Fear Sharp Little Needles. And, yeah, it kind of took me by surprise going back to this and suddenly realising, oh yeah, that's the story it came from.
In the climax of the story, a large group of people attempt to pull an adult version to shore after accidentally hooking it on a rope. The creature shows unpleasant signs of intelligence, including an echoing laugh as it escapes. Yeah, I remember, it's a long time since I've read this story as well, but I remember having a very, well, you know, what the aim of Weird Tales is to have a weird atmosphere, and I remember it embodying that very well, yeah.
And then, of course, we get onto the Call of Cthulhu in 1926, where Cthulhu famously dwells beneath the sea, imprisoned in the corpse city of Rillier, dead but dreaming. Of course, he's not the only such great old one trapped beneath the waves.
Those old ones were now gone, inside the earth and under the sea, but their dead bodies had told their secrets in dreams to the first men, who formed a cult which had never died.
But the ocean seems to lessen the power of these entities.
In the elder time, chosen men had talked with the entombed old ones in dreams. But then something had happened. The great stone city of Rillier, with its monoliths and sepulchres, had sunk beneath the waves and the deep waters, full of one primal mystery through which not even thought can pass, had cut off the spectral intercourse. But memory never died, and high priests said that the city would rise again when the stars were right. Then came out of the earth the black spirits of the earth, mouldy and shadowy, and full of dim rumours, picked up in caverns beneath forgotten sea bottoms.
I do like that bit of description there about the deep waters, full of the one primal mystery through which not even thought can pass. So the ocean is so powerful that it even contains entities such as Cthulhu, stopping them influencing the world. And of course, there's an entire chapter in the story called The Madness from the Sea, which I think kind of sets the template for Lovecraft there. I shall never sleep calmly again when I think of the horrors that lurk ceaselessly behind life in time and space, and of those unhallowed blasphemies from elder stars which dream beneath the sea, known and favoured by a nightmare cult ready and eager to loose them on the world whenever another earthquake shall heave their monstrous stone city again to the sun and air. And of course, the whole story ends up with that battle between Cthulhu and a steamship, which, let's just say, is a draw.
We then get The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath in 1927, in which Randolph Carter sails out of Duluth Lane and he catches sight of something that echoes Lovecraft's other stories about sunken cities.
That night, the moon was very bright, and one could see a great way down in the water. There was so little wind that the ship could not move much, and the ocean was very calm. Looking over the rail, Carter saw many fathoms deep the dome of a great temple, and in front of it an avenue of unnatural sphinxes leading to what was once a public square. Dolphins sported merrily in and out of the ruins, and porpoises revelled clumsily here and there, sometimes coming to the surface and leaping clear out of the sea. Then, by the watery moonlight, he noticed an odd high monolith in the middle of that central court and saw something that was tied to it. And when, after getting a telescope from the captain's cabin, he saw that bound thing was a sailor in the silk robes of Oriab, head downward, without any eyes, he was glad that a rising breeze soon took the ship ahead to more healthy parts of the sea.
That sounds like a lovely place to visit.
It hadn't occurred to me just how much Lovecraft reuses these images over and over again in his stories. These monoliths beneath the sea, these sunken cities that rise up, the dolphins, the porpoises, and so on. It's just the way they echo through the whole thing that it doesn't feel like repetition. It does feel like a motif.
Mm.
And of course, in 1931, we've got The Shadow over Innsmouth, which we just spent a long time discussing in other episodes. But obviously, there's the sunken city of Yahannath Leigh in there, the Deep One City. And there's also, again, that mention of another part of a different Deep One City that had risen up from the seabed in the Pacific Islands.
And then we have At the Mountains of Madness in 1931. There's quite a lot of sea action in that. Which tells us about when the Elder Things came to Earth. They initially built their cities below the waves. The pressure of the ocean depths was nothing to the entities that could fly through the vacuum of space. With the aid of the Shoggoths, the small, low cities under the sea grew to vast and imposing labyrinths of stone. According to one of the sculptured maps, the whole globe was then underwater, with stone cities scattered farther and farther from the Antarctic as eons passed. Another map shows a vast bulk of dry land around the South Pole, where it is evident that some of the beings made experimental settlements, though their main centres were transferred to the nearest sea bottom.
Again, we see mention of land rising from the ocean depths. With the upheaval of new land in the South Pacific, tremendous events began. Some of the marine cities were hopelessly shattered.
This is one of the things we see in Lovecraft's stories here, I think is exemplified by most of the scenarios and other things we'll talk about. But it's like you can make reference to those things, but it's quite hard to put those things in the story because, you know what, I can't breathe underwater. I've been noting down like TV shows and now I've just remembered Patrick Duffy and the Man from Atlantis.
Oh, yes.
Who could, of course, breathe underwater. When you talk about a film or a story or whatever set around the sea, you're either on a boat or you're on an island or you're in a coastal town or you're possibly in a submarine. There's a few in submarines, but there's not many where you're actually in the sea.
Hmm.
And even these stories of Lovecraft, we get reference to things being in the sea, but we're not. There's very few stories where we're actually in the sea. In fact, I'm not sure there's any.
Well, except the temple.
Yeah, that's probably the only example then, yeah, I can think of.
Oh, The Man from Atlantis. I remember being very briefly obsessed with that series when it was on.
Mm.
And I was, what, 10 or 11 or something like that when it came out. Because it was just so weird. I mean, I'm sure it's not weird if you go back and look at it now.
I think it probably is.
Maybe. But to 10 or 11-year-old me, yeah, it was something really quite marvellous. This mysterious amphibious man who washes up on shore with no memory and who's got links perhaps to this undersea civilization where I think some of the other people from Atlantis come out looking for him or something like that.
And especially as the week before, he was in Dallas.
Yeah. And then we move on to another story we discussed not too long ago, which is Out of the Eons by H.P. Lovecraft for Hazel Heald, written in 1935. And once again, we have the seabed rising, bringing horrors to the surface world. On May 11th, 1878, Captain Charles Weatherby of the freighter Eridanus, bound from Wellington, New Zealand, to Valparaiso, Chile, had sighted a new island unmarked on any chart and evidently of volcanic origin. It projected quite boldly out of the sea in the form of a truncated cone. A landing party under Captain Weatherby noted evidences of long submersion on the rugged slopes which they climbed, while at the summit were signs of recent destruction, as by an earthquake. Among the scattered rubble were massive stones of manifestly artificial shaping, and a little examination disclosed the presence of some of that prehistoric Cyclopean masonry found on certain Pacific islands and forming a perpetual archaeological puzzle.
Moving on a year to 1936, we have The Night Ocean by Robert Barlow and H.P. Lovecraft. Lovecraft's final visit to the seaside feels very different from his other work. While there's still lurking horror in the humanoid figures who rise from the surf at night, probably with murderous intent, the descriptions of the ocean itself are more poetic and ambiguous, and from that description alone, I'm suddenly thinking of that Doug McClure spectacular Humanoids from the Deep.
No, it's very different. Very. Oh, God. Yeah, if you want to see me rant about Humanoids from the Deep, I did write a review of it, which is on Blasphemous Tomes, and I have problems with that film. I have deep, deep problems with that film.
Even yet, I do not know why the ocean holds such a fascination for me. But then, perhaps none of us can solve those things. They exist in defiance of all explanation. There are men, and wise men, who do not like the sea for its lapping surf on yellow shores, and they think us strange who love the mystery of the ancient and unending deep. Yet for me, there is a haunting and inscrutable glamour in all the ocean's moods. It is in the melancholy silver foam beneath the moon's waxen corpse. It hovers over the silent and eternal waves that beat on naked shores. It is there when all is lifeless save for unknown shapes that glide through somber depths. And when I behold the awesome billows surging in endless strength, there comes upon me an ecstasy akin to fear, so that I must abase myself before this mightiness, that I may not hate the clotted waters and their overwhelming beauty. Vast and lonely is the ocean, and even as all things came from it, so they shall return thereto.
Yeah, I find that an oddly beautiful bit of writing.
Mm, it is.
It doesn't feel at all like Lovecraft. I don't know how much of this story is Barlow, because Barlow as we were talking about with Robert Bloch in the previous episode, was very young when he contacted Lovecraft and started collaborating with him. I think he was something like 17 at the time they co-wrote this story.
Yeah, he wouldn't be much older than that here.
Maybe I'm doing him a disservice, and that doesn't feel like the writing of a 17-year-old, but at the same time, it doesn't feel like Lovecraft either. It is a much more emotional bit of writing than you normally get from Lovecraft.
Yeah.
And when I was doing the research for this episode and putting these things together, I realised that I'd never actually read The Night Ocean before. It's in The Horror in the Museum and Other Tales, but not in the version I've got. It was one that was added in subsequent editions, but I've got the first edition, and that did not include The Night Ocean. And so somehow I'd gone all these years without ever reading it, and I read it, was it last night or the night before, and I feel like I've been missing out all these years. It's one of my favourite Lovecraft stories now.
Oh, yeah, I'm not sure if I've read it. Barlow, I just checked, would be 19 in 1936, so he's young, but I mean, you know, people can write perfectly well at 19. You know, they can, you've got some fantastic authors at a young age, so... Yeah, I don't know how much of an influence Lovecraft had. You can see some possible influence from Lovecraft on this, but what the balance of writing is, I don't know. It may be recorded somewhere.
But all in all, I think this is a beautiful story. And not even just in the prose, just in the content, it doesn't feel much like Lovecraft either. Mm. There is that weirdness to the whole thing and that sense of mystery, but it... differs an awful lot from Lovecraft's stories in that it does primarily seem to be a mood piece. It's about the character's relationship with the night ocean, with this body of water and the strange things that come out. And at some point he discovers what he thinks might be a rotten human hand left behind by one of these things. And it almost feels like Carl McLachlan's character finding the ear in Blue Velvet. It is a wonderfully dreamlike story, and I adored it.
And we'll be back after a short break to talk about inspirations from nature and folklore.
Remind me, you're at the salon. What's going on back there?
The Apocalypse Players present A Message of Art by Matt Sanderson.
Well, you know what he's like. He's insane.
He has been kept late at the gallery conducting a ritual.
He's passionate and arrogant, but I don't know if he is loop-de-loop.
Everyone seems to flock to me, but not this evening. Everyone's flocking to you.
Something really unusual about the quality of her skin.
Yes, but what did you want to take?
I've just been overdoing it. I haven't really slept.
I think he is gravely ill.
Part of a season of nameless horrors from the Apocalypse Players.
It begins.
Here we go.
Allons-y!
What a wonderful evening.
I don't want to hear the song again.
Well, there's blood splatter, right?
Come to Paris, they said. It'll be romantic, they said.
It wasn't a great idea.
I am sweating.
Flaking skin.
The payment is blood.
Suddenly very nervous.
Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Good Friends of Jackson Elias. Listener donations keep this show running, and every penny helps. If you'd like to support the show, please head to patreon.com/goodfriendsofjacksonelias. Thank you.
As promised, we're back. There was a short break indeed, and now we're talking about inspirations from nature and folklore.
Let's take a look at some inspirations we can take from nature and folklore regarding the ocean.
First of all, I mean, what is it about the ocean that makes it such rich inspiration for horror?
Well, I think fundamentally when you go to the ocean, it can be entrancingly beautiful, and it can also be powerfully destructive and terrifying from one day to the next. And all we can see is the surface. There's so much below that, so much unknown to it. That once we go there for pleasure, here we go to the seaside for pleasure, we take in the sea view and the sea air and all that. This is lovely. But it's also very perilous, you know, to go out swimming in certain places, tremendously dangerous. Even, you know, walking on a beach or whatever in some places is very dangerous at certain times of the day. And, you know, going out in a boat, well, at least you can end up seasick, if not shipwrecked, and all sorts of terrible things can happen to you. So just the very nature of the ocean, I think, as long as people have existed, is going to have held both a sense of wonder and a sense of terror.
There's also an aspect that it's one of the more mobile aspects of the real world, that you can look at a field, you can look at a forest, you can look at trees, maybe to a lesser extent, and they're quite static. I mean, the wind obviously will make the branches of trees move a bit like arms, or the breeze might move along grass or wheat or etc. But the ocean is constantly moving. There's never a time when you can look at it and go, oh, that's just like a flat sheet of glass. There's always waves, there's always movement, and there's always something happening out there. It's one of the most unstatic parts of the natural world around you. And people have likened that to think that, maybe skipping forward a little bit to the discussing this in folklore, they've attributed very human features to it, or even that it's very, very much a thing that's alive because it's moving, whereas they might look at a mountain and go, well, that's just rock, it's dead. But no, they see something very different about the ocean, that it's set very much a separate thing entirely from the rest of the natural world.
And also, I think there's that duality that it is both the thing that birthed us, that gives us life through fishing communities and so on, but also is absolutely hostile to human life in almost every way. You can drown at sea, you can get lost at sea. There's tsunamis. Just everything about it seems set up to kill you. We're both drawn to it and are rightfully terrified of it.
Yeah, I mean, the most fundamental thing we need is water to survive, and yet we can't drink seawater. Well, we can, but it's not very good for us.
Yes.
And there's loads of it. So, yeah, being stuck in a boat in the ocean must be terrible, right? But having all water everywhere and not a drop to drink.
I remember reading a book when I was a kid that came out in the early 70s. This book called Survive the Savage Sea by Dougal Robertson, supposedly nonfiction, told by one of the people involved, of a family who were shipwrecked and ended up having to go into a life raft and, well, survived on the sea for a length of time until they were rescued. And it's just the various attempts to survive there, just without food, without water, exposed to the elements. One of the things that stuck with me was they'd try different ways of collecting rainwater. But one of the things that they did was they had managed to salvage a fishing line from the boat before it went down. And so they'd catch fish, and they'd also managed to catch flying fish sometimes as well above the surface, but they'd mostly fish for fish. And one of their main sources of fluid, if I remember correctly, was the spinal fluid of fish, that they'd find these fish, crack their spines open, and just, you know, eke out these drops of spinal fluid just as a way of keeping alive. That just really stuck in my head.
Yeah.
Yummy.
I think there's a lot of liquid in those, but yeah, who knows?
But I guess if you're completely parched, just a few drops won't be important. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah. There's also this, you know, as we said about what the sea does, it washes you up far from home as well. So there's a rich vein of stories of, you know, from Robinson Crusoe and so on, to Lord of the Flies, Castaway with Tom Hanks, you know, all these stories where you've got someone who's just washed up. In some cases, that can be pretty nightmarish.
Mm.
A good starting point for scenarios as well. Yeah, you're all taking part in this cruise, cut to the next scene where you're collecting your stuff up on a beach somewhere, and you know, what's that noise coming from the trees?
It's that smoke monster that's moving out there that may or may not ever get a decent resolution to that story.
But there's also what you were talking about earlier, Paul, with the opaqueness of the ocean, how you can just sort of see the surface of it, but you've got no idea what's going on underneath. And I think that is just such an evocative thing for the human imagination. In that darkness down there, particularly as we know some of the weird shit that really is down there, it's possible to imagine almost anything down there, as Lovecraft did, you know, lost cities and giant monsters and so on. It's difficult not to kind of imagine that stuff, really.
Yeah, and it's not even lost civilizations, is it? I mean, it's shipwrecks and so on as well. Mm. I mean, some of those, what they hold can be quite remarkable. Real world ones I'm talking about. It's they're constantly being found and fascinating stuff.
Well, there's even some thinking of just natural formations. Well, this is where you get into debates whether they're natural or not. Natural formations that have been found relatively recently as well, that have sparked a lot of debate in the scientific community as to whether are they man-made or are they just natural structures, a bit like the one that's called Japan's Atlantis. I'm probably going to butcher the pronunciation of this. The Yonaguni Monument, which is this wonderful location that's off the coast of Japan that almost looks like a step pyramid under the ocean that was discovered during the 1980s. And a bit more recently, the Baltic Sea anomaly that was all over the papers that pretty much proclaimed the Millennium Falcon has been found at the bottom of the Baltic.
What?
It just looks, it's this formation on the seabed that looks a lot like the Millennium Falcon.
Awesome.
And also, wasn't there, I remember us discussing this in the Edgar Cayce episode, that purported Atlantis off the coast of Florida, is that right?
The road that, or rather the structure that people think is a road which goes perpendicular to the Florida coastline out into the Atlantic, right. Yes, yeah.
Mm.
Which again is also talked about at length by our good friend...
Graham Hancock.
I was going to say Ancient Apocalypse Man, yes.
Yeah, I remember him talking about that. Yeah. And in terms of folklore, I mean, there's obvious ones everybody knows about, like mermaids and sirens and so on, and all these sea creatures and things, which you can imagine how tales of those such things would appear, because just from being out at sea and seeing, I don't know, seals and various creatures pop up out of the water, and people's imagination as it is, they're going to imagine all sorts of things.
Well, and clearly a lot of this stuff influenced Lovecraft as well, with the tales of the Kraken very much feeding into Cthulhu.
Yeah, and the sound of whale song through the hulls of ships and so on is a kind of an ethereal, strange and beautiful sound.
Although you say strange and beautiful sounds from the ocean, I can counterpoint that with another folklore example.
Oh, good.
There's some tales, I think these originate from Brittany and from Scotland, from memory. These are detailed in a book that I would wholeheartedly recommend. It was originally published as Superstitions of Sailors back in 1928, but it was subsequently republished more recently in 1995 by Sennett Press. So the studio editions run of Myths and Legends, where they just renamed it aptly The Sea. So they took away a bit of its more evocative title, where it talks about the two interpretations of what the sound of the ocean waves mean.
Uh-huh.
One of the folklores of Brittany says that the sound of crashing waves is actually the sounds of the dead at sea that are calling out to be, or they're lamenting the fact their bodies haven't been found, and that they desperately want to be buried in consecrated ground on terra firma rather than being lingering still beneath the ocean waves.
Oh, nice.
Hmm.
There was a more friendly and more Disney version, you could say, from Scotland, where it was almost the sound of dogs running across the open sea, almost like they're running across the open fields, but instead running across the water.
You said the book was at first titled Superstitions of Sailors, is that right?
That's right.
I don't know much about sailing, really, but from various things I've read, it seems that sailors are very superstitious people. There seem to be lots of superstitions attached to sailing and beliefs you should do this and that would be bad luck and this would be good luck and so on, perhaps more than anything else. And perhaps because they're at the, you know, the mercy of the ocean. I don't know why that is.
It's unlucky to be superstitious.
Absolutely, Matt.
But yeah, I think you're right, Paul, that it would be weird if they weren't superstitious, because if they're spending their lives out there in an environment that is just deadly.
Mm.
The slightest mistake, the slightest bit of bad luck, and that's it. Game over.
Just flicking through that, thinking of, particularly when you're saying about bad luck, there are different little rituals they can perform which can hopefully alleviate some of the ill luck coming to them. And quote from the book, English sailors make the sign of the cross when they see the ninth wave come on the coast of the, I'm probably going to butcher the pronunciation here, but it looks like somewhere in France, Charente in Furiel. Some sailors believe that the tenth wave is the most powerful. This superstition already exists in antiquity and continued until quite recently. And so that was 1928 when he was writing, and he still says quite recently that the people are still adhering to this superstition even then.
Well, and of course, you know, the ninth wave gives us the Kate Bush mini album of the same name, the B-side, The Hounds of Love, which, yeah, is a nice little bit of ocean-going horror in itself. Just the thoughts, the stream of consciousness this woman lost at sea, slowly dying from exposure.
Yeah, apparently there's something about third, ninth, and tenth waves that they are considered to be the most powerful, or at least the most significant or ominous.
But also, I mean, I take a lot of inspiration personally from the creatures of the sea. When I was a kid, I used to read loads of books on the natural world, particularly the world under the sea. I was fascinated with marine life. And a lot of that bleeds through into the stuff that I write and come up with in games. Certainly when I'm coming up with creatures in the mythos and describing stuff, I keep coming back to things that have stuck in my mind from these books and from visits to aquariums and the like. I mean, simple things like lampreys. I mean, lampreys and hagfish are fucking weird for a start. You know, these eel-like things with these circular mouths full of teeth. And it's difficult not to look at a lamprey's mouth and think of monsters. Hagfish are even weirder because they also exude all this slime as well as their defense mechanism. If you capture a hagfish, it'll exude something like 50% of its body mass as slime just as a way of getting away, which is, I think, something you could have quite a lot of fun with. I used the image of mermaids' purses quite a lot as well when I was doing Bleak Prospect. The egg sacs of sharks and rays, which look like these sort of dumplings from hell that you can see the eggs and sometimes embryos moving around in. And, I mean, just other stuff, like if I were to try to come up with a weird description of a shoggoth, I'd probably fall back on something like a nudibranch. These small shellless mollusks that move through the water in strange ways and have vivid coloration on them and look like the closest thing to aliens I think you could encounter on this earth. Honestly, I've been just digging through any set of pictures or videos of deep sea creatures will probably give you inspiration for any number of mythos creatures.
Although when you say things like mermaids' purses, my first thought actually goes to ravioli or pasta.
You're not a big fan of seafood, though, are you, Matt?
Oh, I hate it with a passion.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something you and Lovecraft had in common. How do we distill all this into our games?
One of the bits that I'm using at the minute for a Vampire the Requiem game I'm running is using the thread that's been tugged upon in various anthropological circles, that there's a connection between the melting of the ice sheets at the end of the last ice age and the stories in the Bible of the Great Deluge. That it's this massive wave of water, or not wave of water, but definitely rising levels of water around the Black Sea and the Mediterranean that completely sunk those areas. So this is why you have little pockets of civilization, mainly from the likes of the Greeks and the Romans, that had populated what was at that time not under the sea, obviously, but they were areas that were on the coast at the time. But as the sea level has risen, they've now been completely submerged. And that's why you've got so much underwater archaeology that takes place around those areas, and what stuff is gradually being retrieved from those depths and being brought back to the world now.
I'm hoping this is called Vampires Don't Surf.
No, I was tying it in with the various bits from the Bible about the Garden of Eden and how the vampiric race first developed and where how it ties into various bits in the Bible. That particular aspect of this being the reason why you've got the stories of the Great Flood tie into a real world, not quite cataclysmic event, because it did take place over multiple decades of the sea level rising significantly quicker than it is today. But just this whole submerging of what was once a populated and thriving area. And it's all this stuff that's been lost, but also now still preserved down there. And we're still finding stuff down there when underwater archaeology takes place.
I mean, that also happened a bit closer to home with Doggerland.
Except not as well, it's populated, yes, but there's not anything by remarkable buildings or structures that people have found, because it's mostly prehistoric in that sense. There's like arrowheads and other bits and pieces that have been found. But again, Doggerland fits into the same kind of aspect for me. It's a fascinating thing to think what could be down there. But in reality, yeah, a lot of tree stumps and some arrowheads, not really all that much of interest compared to the likes of the Mediterranean or the Black Sea.
For people who haven't heard of it, Doggerland was effectively the land bridge between the British Isles and mainland Europe, which flooded at some point in the distant past and became the English Channel.
And the southern part of the North Sea.
Yeah.
And have you used the ocean much in your scenario, Scott?
As I mentioned, I use an awful lot of inspiration from sea creatures, but I don't think I've ever actually set a game at sea. And I've run a few games at sea, but they're scenarios that other people have written. There was one I was going to recommend because I ran it fairly recently, a couple of years ago for a convention, and I was quite taken with it, which is a scenario called Sound of the Sea by Philip G. Yorth, which you can find on the Miskatonic Repository, which involves a ferry journey or a boat journey from Hamburg that, well, obviously goes wrong because it wouldn't be much of a scenario otherwise. And, yeah, there's some really interesting stuff in there, and it's a great sort of pressure cooker convention scenario. If you fancy a bit of aquatic horror, I kind of recommend that. And I'd also recommend Brian Quartermunch's Do Not Call Up That Which You Cannot Put Down, which, without going heavily into spoilers, owes an awful lot to Jaws. And it's really got that kind of feel to it, and I enjoyed that immensely.
There's a few I've played. Definitely I can think of Cthulhu scenarios set at sea, which I think Paul was in this playthrough of the Mauritania that Matt Knott ran for us as one of the kind of interludes when we played Masks of Nyarlathotep.
That rings a bell.
I remember reading that years ago.
It's set on, other than as it says, the Mauritania. So you've got a nice slice of ocean-going luxury as you journey between one place and another. I think the scenario actually pitches it as when Cthulhu investigators find something that they don't want to deal with and they just run away to go from point A to point B, if they're going to get on a long sea voyage to regain some sand, throw this at them. And then you've got antics that take place on the boat that involves a knife and connected to a certain Jack that ran around Whitechapel at one point in time. It's more that it's set on a ship, but the actual instances of what goes on the boat are very, very not related to the ocean. You've also got, in a similar vein, one by a good friend of ours, The Transatlantic Terror for Age of Cthulhu by John Hook. That's a fun little scenario. I've seen some playthroughs and reviews of that, which Seth Skorkowski did a good review of that back in the day.
And you've got one that takes in the sea, or at least the sea view, Matt, as I recall, down in the southern states somewhere, in Florida?
But yeah, Waiting for the Hurricane takes place mainly in Key West in Florida during a hurricane, but I hadn't really thought of it as being a kind of seafaring scenario because it's set on a coast, but it was more about the storm than it was about the ocean.
But I think anything, even Innsmouth and so on, they're very much influenced by the ocean because they're seaside towns, you know? The one you thought I was alluding to, is it called just The Blue?
That's it.
Or Blue?
Yeah.
In issue 7, is it, of the Blasphemous Tome?
That's the one, which is not too far away from Key West. It's only, a couple hundred miles as the crow flies down in the Bahamas.
And other ones that, some of which I played and some not, there's A Slow Boat to China, which features in the Pulp Cthulhu core book, which is a voyage from San Francisco to Shanghai. And I'm sure nothing goes wrong at all. Just a lovely journey, a cruise.
Can you imagine playing a Call of Cthulhu scenario where you're on a boat going for weeks and you're playing it out and nothing bad happens? It'd be kind of almost like a meta bad thing happening, sitting there waiting for the bad thing to happen and just getting frustrated when everything goes smoothly.
Yeah, that'd be a nightmare.
But if you take a long sea voyage, it's a great way to regain sand between chapters in some of the longer campaigns.
But you don't play it over a course of 4 hours.
Do you want to spend weeks of game time just playing shuffleboard?
Well, you can do clay pigeon shooting off the back of the ship as well.
Oh, God, yes.
To up your shotgun skill.
Yeah.
It's either you sit in your cabin reading the Necronomicon or you're shooting clay pigeons off the back of the ship, or a bit of both, which is usually a recipe for disaster, because now you've read the Necronomicon and you've got a shotgun.
You're taking me right back to running masks in the 1980s when my players absolutely did that.
yeah, totally. And then there's a solo adventure, Alone Against the Tide. I've not played that one, but the solo adventures are a lot of fun. And also The Derelict.
Oh, yeah, yes.
One of the adventures in Peterson's Abominations.
Mm-hmm. I played that with Sandy years back at a convention.
Right.
That's a fun scenario.
Hmm.
There's one that I'd like to try, mainly because it's almost a direct sequel to one of my favourites that we actually talked about earlier in the episode. The sequel to The Temple called City in the Sea, which is in the Cthulhu Now source book.
Oh.
Yeah, pretty much you go down in a submarine to go down to the temple.
Right.
That reminds me, have either of you played Grace Under Pressure?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
It's one of these games I keep hearing secondhand reports of, but it sounds like a real classic of oceanic horror.
It has its moments.
Yeah, I mean, it's a kind of early 90s, late 80s kind of scenario. It's pretty simple, but it's quite theatrical in the way that it's recommended it's played out. You've kind of got one group. There's submarines involved, so you can divide up and you can use radios and put the players in separate rooms or separate games and so on. And there's communication between the two. That theatrical element adds a lot to it, I think, to people's experience of it.
Yeah, I remember hearing about a game that was run at Concrete Cow, I think, where they'd stuck a bunch of people in the cupboard effectively as the second group and given walkie-talkies to each group so they could talk to each other.
That was the game I played in.
Yeah, that was me and Robin.
All right, yeah.
Is that the one you played in, Matt? Were you playing
it? Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah.
Ah, yeah.
Yeah, the only thing I didn't like about the game, no kind of criticism of how it was run.
Is it when we wouldn't let you out of the cupboard?
No, I didn't go in the cupboard. I stayed in the main part of the basement. But no, it's just the opening is kind of quite dry and it very much felt like Beyond the Mountains of Madness. It's not quite doing a ship manifest, but it was kind of the tedious, here's we're going to set the tone with all this stuff that means nothing before you actually get into the meat of the scenario.
Mm.
When stuff actually gets going, it is good.
And of course, Paul, you published one a couple of years back, Full Fathom 5.
Yeah, I mean, that's my kind of ocean-going adventure, really. That's available on DriveThruRPG and is heavily influenced by Moby Dick. I've read Moby Dick and I was a big fan of that. That book is a great work that explores the whaling ships of the early sort of half of the 19th century. And yeah, it's a fantastic cast of characters all aboard this relatively small ship. And I just sort of thought it'd be a wonderful place for an adventure. And I think one of the good things that being on a ship gives you is inbuilt isolation. Nowadays, I don't think historical ocean going films are that popular. We see that with Master and Commander, which was a fantastic film from about 20 years ago with Russell Crowe. But it didn't do that well at the box office. But if you get a chance to see that, it's not a horror film. There are some fairly not creepy bits in it, but horrifying bits in it, particularly the surgery that is conducted by the ship's doctor. Or he's not actually a doctor, but yes, he is the ship's doctor. That's a fantastic reference for sort of like the historical period. Just gives you a really good feel for the setting. Towards the end of that film, I think they do adopt the guise of a whaling ship to sort of attract in this French vessel. They try to sort of fake that they're whalers and they can't get away because they're not a fighting vessel is the trick they try and play. Yeah, I think being out in the ocean also gives you a link to all those things that, all those stories that Lovecraft wrote that we referenced about things coming up out of the sea, lost civilizations, creatures that are in the sea, you know, it could be any of them. So it's kind of a rich vein that hasn't been used that much, I would say. So I would say there's a lot more that could be done with that, I think.
And it occurs to me similarly that I don't think I've seen many Cthulhu scenarios that have used the kind of setup that we see in The Abyss and Deep Star 6 and films of that ilk, where you've got undersea exploration, you've got deep sea exploration and bases that have been set up
underwater,
which is absolutely perfect for that setup. And yeah, Underwater was, you know, a film that came out a few years back, which very much explicitly uses that setup for a Cthulhu mythos story, which you're looking unimpressed, Matt. I know I saw it and thought it was meh.
Yeah, I would have liked it if I could see anything.
That was the problem I had, yeah. I get that they were trying to play up the murkiness and the sense of threat that not being able to see what's going on can lend, but at the same time, it made it really difficult to connect with what was going on. The whole film just felt like what I feel like if I take my glasses off. I can see the vague shapes of things. I find it difficult to identify anything, and I don't necessarily want to do that for 90 minutes on the screen.
I completely agree. It felt like watching the Vuvuzela Itch again. With, oh look, there's a black screen where apparently something interesting is happening. That
was partly your television though, Matt, to be fair.
That was almost entirely your television.
And we've looked at the inspiration from Lovecraft for these things. What about, and I'm going to turn to you, Matt, as our resident authority on this, where did the sea devils come from, if not deep ones?
The Silurians.
In Doctor Who, I'm talking about now, just for...
When they saw the cataclysm coming, when this small planet was destined to collide with Earth, they all went into their hibernation units all across the world and under the sea.
Down where it's pretty under that sea.
They went down there and unfortunately their timing mechanism was faulty. Pretty much everywhere, all of their settlements had faulty timing mechanisms.
So their alarm clocks didn't go off?
Essentially that, yes. They just continued to sleep. A bit like me most mornings.
But that's interesting that, you know, instead of being like the classic deep ones, they are almost like an offshoot of the serpent people in Call of Cthulhu terms, which also makes me think, going back to the night ocean just for a moment, the creatures that are coming out of the surf there, it's easy perhaps to read them as deep ones, but they don't feel much like deep ones. And I think at some point they're referred to as seagulls. And I just like the idea of aquatic ghouls.
Something I think that maybe it's in Secrets of Japan that's ringing me a little bell in the back of my head, thinking about underwater ghouls. I think that might be in something that's featured in that book.
Oh, neat.
As an alternative ocean-based setting, there's also oil rigs. I do remember playing an adventure on an oil rig some years ago, which, well, I was going to say isn't a place for a campaign, but you can imagine a whole TV series set aboard an oil rig. There probably is one. I don't know.
There was one that came out on Prime Video, what was it, last year or the year before? And I've already forgotten what it's called because it was so fucking boring.
I think it's called The Rig. It's that kind of generic a title.
But, I mean, you can imagine definitely a place for a Call of Cthulhu scenario, because, I mean, I imagine they're actually quite large structures, easily isolated, particularly with bad weather.
There is one. We've already mentioned the book. It's in Peterson's Abominations, which is called Mohole.
Oh, is it? Right, okay.
The name references the inspiration for the Doctor Who story, which this is a carbon copy of that particular plot. Which, right. When I played it, I went, hang on a minute, that's the same character name. That's a variation of this character that appears in this story. The whole thing suddenly puckered up. The light bulb went off on my head and went, God, we're playing this particular... Actually, I won't say the name of the story in case anyone wants to play it, because if you know the story, you're going to know how that scenario plays out down to the minute detail.
Fair enough.
Because even the same thing happens to the same characters with those particular names. It's one of my top two favourite Doctor Who scenarios across the whole of the original classic run. And it was like, yay, that's great. It's a scenario that's based on it. But crap, I know what's going to happen. But the real inspiration for the writer at the time was the original Project Mohole, which was I think it was funded by the US government, where they wanted to perform deep sea drilling down an undersea valley, not quite as deep as like the Mariana Trench, because it was impossible to go down that far with the equipment at the time. But they tried to do a deep sea borehole that went down to try and penetrate the Earth's crust, and that they were trying to basically go down as deep as they could. And for whatever reason, that project was cancelled, classified, and buried away in a vault so that no one knows exactly why they cancelled it. And so the author of the Doctor Who story went, I can make a story around that, but not set it in the ocean. I will set it on land. But yeah, when Peter's Abominations came out, they put it pretty much exact same premise onto an oil rig. So you've got this oil rig drilling down into a real location in the North Sea, which I actually reference in my first published scenario from the Easter Terrorist called The Love of Money, where there's a feature in the North Sea, I believe it's called the Devil's Hole, where you have a large valley in the North Sea floor, which fishing trawlers used to drive their nets over it. And occasionally it would just get lost in this void down there. And they used to be quite, again, superstitious about, oh, what's down there? What's taking all our fishing lines? It's just that it's the sea bottom being this great big dip that the nets are getting sunk in. That's all it is. So completely normal and rational explanation for it. But of course, it got this kind of air of mysticism and air of, oh, it's a bad, bad place. Don't go near there. And of course, it gets an oil rig built over it with a giant drill going down into the sea floor in the scenario. And the PCs get called in and bad stuff happens, unsurprisingly.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're listening to the Good Friends of Jackson Elias. You can find show notes for this episode at blasphemoustomes.com, where you will also find links to all our social media presences. We have t-shirts and other merchandise available at our Redbubble store. And if you're enjoying the show, please consider backing us at patreon.com/goodfriendsofjacksonelias. We offer a variety of interesting rewards to our backers, so please do check that out. Thank you for listening. If you are enjoying the Good Friends of Jackson Elias, we would love it if you let people know. Whether this means leaving a message in a bottle and consigning it to the ocean depths, or perhaps more usefully, writing a review somewhere where reviews can be found, or even just telling people about it on social media if it seems like the kind of thing they'd like.
Okay, well, that's all for this episode. You've been listening to the Good Friends of Jackson Elias. Until next time, it's a goodbye from me.
And cheerio from me.
And farewell from me.
Hello?
BlasphemousTomes.com.